Okay, let's get started. So, we're in the middle of running through some opening kinds of discussions about the nature of logical consequence. And what we're going to be doing today is talking a bit more about truth and proof. So talking about two kinds of approaches to the nature of consequence. One driven by the idea that where some conclusion is a consequence or a logical consequence of some premises, that's because there's a proof from the premises to the conclusion, right? A derivation moving through a system of clearly defined and articulated rules that takes you from the premises through some array of transformations to the conclusion. That'd be a kind of proof theoretic, deduction-based account of logical consequence. And we want, in a way, to compare and contrast that kind of approach to the nature of logical consequence with another kind of approach that, in a way, is currently more orthodox. So that's the kind of approach you learn about in first-year logic when you learn about validity proper, where that's characterised by appeal to truth. And more generally by other so-called semantical notions like reference or satisfaction when one moves into cases like predicate logic, first-order logic. So in that case, the idea is something like this, that some premises have a conclusion as their consequence, just in case it can't be that the premises are all true and the conclusion false. More generally, that there's no model of the premises that isn't also a model of the conclusion. So no system that makes a situation where the premises could all be correct without thereby making the conclusion correct. So the general question here is, what's the relation between consequence and proof? And we're going to be moving through that topic to a discussion of one of the issues that arises here, the notion of conservativeness. Connectedly, we'll be moving on to talk about Tarski on consequence, and in particular, I guess this time, we're not going to get any further than talking about his responses to proof-theoretic conceptions of consequence. So he has kind of objection to that approach to consequence. And then we'll move on to give, next time, to give an account of his positive views about consequence. Okay, so skipping through a kind of recap, last time we looked at these two kinds of approaches by thinking about a proof or deduction system and a kind of semantics for a formal language. So we said that a semantics is a structure or a model, typically some kind of set theoretic machine that involves the assignment of truth values in propositional cases, truth values to sentence letters, and then to formulae involving those sentence letters by the use of things like truth tables, where truth tables are just the kind of rule system that tells you what assignments to your basic propositional letters do to assignments to more complex sentences or formulae involving logical connectives. So you're all familiar or should be familiar with this kind of setup, and this is just the kind of rule book that tells you what happens when you assign truth values to these basic sentences, how that projects up to assignments of truth values to more complex sentences in accord with the meanings of the logical constants. So on this view, as I've said, logical consequence is characterized in something like the following way. A set of formulae has as a logical consequence some other formula, just in case there's no structure, no assignment of truth values that fits the rules, in which all the formulae in the premises take the value true and the conclusion takes the value false. Okay, that's kind of standard form account of validity or consequence in semantical terms. And then a proof is a finite sequence of formulae starting with the premises, if any, and ending with the conclusion, where each step in the sequence is either a premise or an application of one of the rules governing manipulations of those premises, including things like introductions of assumptions and the like. and this whole derivation, its conjoined application of the system of deduction rules terminates with the conclusion. If you've got that, then you have a proof, and then an account of logical consequence based on proof would be an account that derived consequence from this structure. So said you've got a case of consequence just in case there's a possible proof of the conclusion from the premises. Okay, we'll say more about something more specific about what kind of account might fit that characterization, what kinds of accounts have been offered. Okay, so we said last time that the single turn style, standing between formulae, is used to denote the existence of a proof or a derivation, typically in a particular system, but we don't need to worry about that for our purposes. So this set, and this double turn style, characterises the existence of a case of semantical consequence between premises and conclusion. And then we say that a logic sound, just in case, whenever you can derive a conclusion from some premises, that conclusion is also a semantical consequence of the premises. Okay, it's just the definition. And we say, I mean, in effect, that says that your deduction rules will never take you from true premises, what your semantics characterises as true premises, to what your semantics characterises as a false conclusion, which you might think is a good thing. And we say that the logic's complete just in case whenever a conclusion's a semantical consequence of premises, it's possible to join the premises and conclusion by appeal to one's rules of proof. So whenever your system tells you that in fact it can't be that your premises are true and your conclusion is false, it'll be possible, in principle, to construct a derivation, a proof, from the premises to the conclusion. That's what it would be for a system to be complete. There are systems that meet both conditions, but there are also systems, obviously enough, that fail one or both conditions. Now, said last time that intuitively we want a logic to be sound, for otherwise it's going to be possible to prove things that aren't judged valid by our semantics, that aren't judged to be cases of consequence by our semantics. Okay, so ideally you don't really want to have a system that has a semantics and a proof theory such that the semantics tells you that one thing about consequence relations and your proof theory tells you something that seems to be in conflict with that. And it's quite usual to treat failures of soundness as failures with the proof theory, and then to seek to revise that theory accordingly. So it's usual to view failures of soundness as showing that the proof theory is getting something wrong. Okay, so you start with your semantics, you think, well, the semantics is right, and the semantics tells me all about when some conclusions are consequences of some premises. And now if sometimes our proof theory takes us from cases where we have what we take to be true premises to false conclusions, that's a problem with the proof theory. Okay, something's gone wrong. At least one of the rules in the deduction system is problematic. It's not perfectly truth-preserving or what have you. However, at least in some cases, one might also just as reasonably treat that as a failure with the semantics. So you might think, look, my grasp on what follows from what, in some cases at least, is fundamentally driven by what I take to be good rules of deduction, what I take to be good rules of proof. So, you know, if you think it's just obvious on reflection that if A's true and B's true, then A and B is going to be true. I think that's absolutely obvious as a kind of rule of deduction. And then you find your semantics is attributing values to those sentences in such a way that the premises A and B can both be true and the conclusion false, you might think that's not a problem with the deduction system that tells you this is a good rule of inference to follow. Rather, it's a problem with your semantics. Something's gone wrong. And we might think that more generally. Okay, so it might be that in some cases we think that failures of soundness are reasons to revise our deduction theory, our proof theory, and in some cases they're reasons to revise our theory of semantics, our semantical theory. It's somewhat less clear why we should think of completeness as a virtue. So soundness looks like a virtue of the system, right? It's a way of avoiding it looking as though your deduction system is taking you potentially from what your semantics says is true to what your semantics says is false. Completeness says something different. It says that whenever your semantics tells you you have a case of consequence, then it's going to be possible to use your rules of proof, your deduction rules, to trace out that connection between premises and conclusions. So completeness guarantees that wherever you've got a valid connection between premises and conclusion, it's possible to construct a derivation in accordance with the rules of proof governing your system. So completeness is certainly useful, right, since it enables us to keep track of validity by using proofs. Right? If it turns out that you can prove something, that you can't prove something in your system, if you have reason to think it's impossible to present a proof of a conclusion from some premises, if your system's complete, that's a sign that you don't have a case of consequence. Okay, so it means you can exploit your deduction system in exactly the same way you'd exploit your semantics. You'd always get relevantly similar results, assuming soundness. But failure of completeness isn't an obvious failing with either proof theory or semantics. It's not obvious why we should think something's gone wrong just because there are cases of semantical consequence that our proof theory can't capture. It's not clear quite why that should be thought problematic. I mean, we might, for example, think that failure of completeness indicates some kind of epistemological problem about what we can know or about our methods for knowing the things we can know. Because if you've got failure of completeness, you won't in general be able to use your main method, tracing out cases of consequence, the method of proof, in order to come to know whether a consequence relation obtains. And we can find a proof, that's fine. But the absence of a proof, the impossibility of proving a connection, won't reveal to you that there is no such connection. And that might be thought to be an epistemological problem. But in general, we might wonder why we should expect here, as opposed to anywhere else, to be able to exploit a particular way of knowing, like a proof system, in order to know all of the facts in the relevant domain. Okay, as I think I said last time, we wouldn't ordinarily expect to be able to know everything there is to know about the physical universe, right? Unless we were kind of crazed physicists who sometimes present themselves as close to having a theory of absolutely everything. In general, we think there are bound to be things we don't know and probably can't know. Certainly we'll never know, right? So it would take some kind of special pleading in the case of logic to think that the fact that incompleteness reveals there might be some things we can't know about cases of validity, well, we should think that that should reveal a problem as opposed to merely the fact that we're dealing with external information, external facts, things that we don't create, right? Just as we are in physics. So I mean, there's room for dispute there, because you might think that logic is special. Okay, so I've said there's a demand for special pleading. We'd need to say something that might lead us to think we should expect to be able to know all the logical facts, given that we don't expect to be able to know all the facts in any other domain, more or less. But it might be possible to address that need for special pleading. it might be that we think there's something very special about logic as opposed to physics or chemistry or anything else that should lead us to expect features like completeness. So there are at least two connected reasons why we might want to retain a close connection between the nature of consequence and the nature of proof. First of all, logic has traditionally been viewed as a, if not the paradigmatic, domain of a priori inquiry. So we think, if we think that, then we think that if we can have a priori knowledge anywhere, we can know anything just on the basis of thinking really hard about it, reflecting, then it ought to be in logic that we can have such knowledge. It's certainly true that we can have such knowledge in logic a priori, at least so it seems. But the idea is that we might think that logic ought to be entirely accessible by reflective means, by a priori methods. And it's natural to think that the extent of a priori knowledge, in logic at least, is largely shaped, largely determined by the extent of what we can prove. I think, how do you acquire a priori knowledge in logic? Answer, at least for the most part, by proof. And now if it turns out there are supposed truths of logic that we can't get to by appeal to proof, it might look as though those are things we can't know a priori. And then we might think that that shows that they can't really be logical facts, because we think logical facts should all be accessible a priori. So that's one kind of suggestion someone might make. Another kind of suggestion is that logic has traditionally been viewed, right, not universally, but traditionally, at least for the most part, been viewed as a kind of rational starting or stopping point for other kinds of discussions. Right, a place where all normal, reasonably educated people can agree on how disputes are going to be controlled. And perhaps that requires a priori access to the basic connections that logic works. So, you know, if you and I are engaged in some dispute on whatever subject matter, suppose it's a dispute about the ethics of euthanasia, for example, right? Suppose we're having a dispute like that, and you make some claim, and I exploit logic to derive from your claim a logical contradiction, right, perhaps in conjunction with other silly things you've said, right, in that case, seeing that I've won, we might think, right, that any rational person who got themselves into that position would accept that their position was untenable and back off from some of their opening assumptions. So you might think that's only possible insofar as we have this kind of a priori control over the scope of logic. Something that we can always find out about by appeal to a priori methods. I think either of those considerations are especially compelling. Indeed, I think, as I've just stated them, they're full of holes, but they're at least the kinds of considerations that might lead one to expect something like completeness or hope for something like completeness. Okay? Might hope that logic, if nowhere else, is somewhere that as long as we work hard and think hard, deploy reflective methods appropriately, we'll be able to find out all the relevant truths, all the truths that we want to have access to. So quite unlike almost any other area of human inquiry. But it might be right that we can plead for special treatment here due to the way we think of logic distinctively. A, as a priori, and B, as a kind of universal control on rational disputes anywhere, or even rational discussion, if not disputes, everywhere. And there are going to be problems there, right? I keep mentioning without pursuing, and I'm not going to pursue any further. Now I keep mentioning these deviant logicians. Okay, there are these poor benighted souls who think that the logic that you learn in the first year doesn't exhaust possible logics. It's a classical logic of the kind that you adhere to in the first year, won't allow things like contradictions. Right? Moreover, if you get a contradiction, everything follows. It's kind of game over. But there are people who deny that. Okay? There are deviant logicians, diletheists, who think that it's perfectly acceptable in at least some cases for it to be the case that P and not P. They deny that everything follows from that. So you might get in trouble with those guys, right? If you're having an argument with them about euthanasia, you show that their view leads to a contradiction and they just smile and carry on endorsing their position.
Even worse cases, right? I think there's still only one case, and he might have backed down, a case of a trivialist. So a trivialist doesn't merely think that some contradictions are true. They think that all contradictions are true, as part of thinking that absolutely everything is true. Right? So P is true, not P is true, not P is true. I mean, everything's true, for every case you like.
Yeah, but there's only one of those, and he might have backed down. He's Australian. Okay. So it's not trivial that we should straightforwardly accept that stuff, but you might think, look, if there's a dispute between me and one of these diletheists, we at least expect that that dispute will be resolvable by a priori methods. I mean, how else are you going to resolve it? If it's resolvable at all.
So there might be some reasons for hoping, at least, and perhaps for expecting a logical system to be complete. And it'll turn out that our expectations there will make a difference to how we think about the dispute between proof theoretic and semantical approaches to the nature of consequence. I mean, very crudely, right, if all the systems we had in play, all the systems we were willing to count as logic, were both sound and complete, then any result of one treatment of consequence would precisely track the treatment given by the other approach. If you've got a case of semantical consequence, then completeness tells you you're bound to have a case of deductive consequence. If you've got deductive consequence, then soundness tells you you're bound to have a case of semantical consequence. So you'd at least get what we call in the trade extensional equivalence between the two approaches. Right? They give you the same results. They sort piles of arguments into the same parts. But where one loses either soundness or completeness, and most commonly it's completeness that seems to be sacrificed, in those cases it becomes a significant question, right? Significant even with respect to sorting arguments into the good pile and the bad pile, which notion of consequence one takes to have priority, one takes to be the most important. Okay, so that's what we're moving on to talk about now in a bit more detail. I'm going to be talking about truth theoretic and proof theoretic approaches to the nature of logical consequence. So,
the truth theoretic account says something like this. The most fundamental account of logical consequence is something like the account given by the double turnstile. Okay? Can't have a model of the premises that isn't also a model of the conclusion. You can't have an assignment of values to the premises that makes them all true, that doesn't also give the same kind of assignment to the conclusion and make that true. Proof theoretic account, by contrast, says that the most fundamental account of logical consequence is something like the single turnstile account. Right? You've got a case of consequence when you have a deduction in accord with viable deduction rules from the premises to the conclusion. Now, even if these two accounts turn out to run in step to give the same sorting of arguments into cases of consequence, cases not of consequence, one can still distinguish the two kinds of account. Right? They accord priority in different ways. So even if they give the same result, you might nonetheless think that what explains that, what's responsible for that result, is the truth theoretic account. That's what really tells you what consequence is like. Alternatively, you might think what's most fundamental here is the proof theoretic account.
right? And then the truth theory is a kind of free rider over the top of that. So here are some questions we can raise about these accounts. One question is just about either of the accounts, whether they're acceptable. Okay, so it might be that both accounts are completely wrong, or ultimately wrong. So one question is whether there's something right about either or both of these accounts. Second question is whether one or another of the accounts is more fundamental, right? So that's the question I just posed. One kind of question here is whether one of the accounts can be understood independently of the other. Right? It might turn out that they can't. It might turn out that there's no good understanding of what's going on in a proof theoretic treatment of consequence that doesn't make essential reference to notions from a semantical treatment, a truth theoretic treatment. In that case, questions of priority would be problematic. Right? You couldn't say, well, I fully understood from the proof theory what consequence was, and then use that understanding to explain semantical consequence, for example, because your very understanding of the proof theoretic account would have already relied on your understanding of the truth theoretic account. Another question is whether the account, supposing there's an account that can be understood independently of the other account, and perhaps take it to be more fundamental in some way, does that account somehow underwrite an explanation for the correctness, insofar as it is correct, of the other account? Can you explain, for example, by using your deductive account of consequence, why the truth theoretic account turns out to also give you the right results, and vice versa? Because you might think, right, you might think of notions of being more or less fundamental as involving that kind of requirement. If I say some domain is more fundamental than some other domain, the natural expectation first that I can understand the more fundamental domain independently of having a full grasp on what's going on in the less fundamental domain. And also, there's a natural expectation that what's going on in the more fundamental domain helps to explain what's going on in the less fundamental domain. This is what you'd expect, for example, if you thought that what explained the domain of table behaviour was facts in the domain of basic physics or something, right? In that case, if I tell you that I think basic physics is more fundamental than table theory, your natural expectation would be that you could understand basic physics without having to appeal to connections between particles and tables, and moreover, that one could exploit the theory of particle behaviour to explain the theory of table behaviour, at least in principle. And similarly here, right, you might expect. So, we've got our two kinds of accounts. We have at least a working understanding of those two accounts, the proof theoretic and the truth theoretic. One way of thinking about their relations, again, is to think about connections with completeness and soundness and the like. Okay, so suppose we have that, we have a case of semantical consequence according to that account. But according to our best proof theoretic account, we don't have a case of deductive consequence, right? Proof theoretic consequence. So we have a case of incompleteness. The truth theoretic response at that point, right, if we favour the truth theory, our response should be that the proof system we've got there is inadequate. It fails to capture some cases of consequence. It might be there's nothing to be done about that. It might be that it's unfixable. But we think that something was amiss with the proof theory. It didn't do all the work one wants a logic to do. All the work's done by the semantics, and the deduction theory does some of the work, but it can't do everything. By contrast, if we had that circumstance and we favoured proof theory, we'd think of this result as showing that the semantics was inadequate, the semantical account of consequence was inadequate.
right? We're convinced that this isn't a case of consequence, because our best proof theoretic approach to consequence tells us it isn't, and we think that the proof theory is the most fundamental account there is. Okay? So what we discover in discovering a case of incompleteness will be an analogue of what we started saying about soundness. Be a case where the semantical theory leads us astray. It tells us this is a case of consequence when it clearly isn't.
It overreaches in attempting to characterise the relation of consequence. Similarly,
suppose we've got a case where our proof theory tells us we have a case of consequence, but our semantical theory tells us we haven't. That is a case of unsoundness, given our definitions. Again, the truth theoretic response will be that the proof theory's gone wrong. Okay? It views as consequences some things that aren't cases of consequence. It should be revised, or at least treated with caution. Right? Might think, okay, perhaps it's a good heuristic method for tracing out cases of consequence that one employs the proof theory. But it's risky, because sometimes its applications might lead us astray. Right? So it's not to be trusted to do all the work with respect to dealing with cases of consequence. By contrast, if we favour the proof theory, we'd see a case of unsoundness as a case where the semantics is inadequate. Something's gone wrong in our semantical account of consequence. Yeah.
So, this might be a little hard to make, but it seems to be that if you were to say that it fails to capture some genuine consequences, then that's still an appeal to semantics. In other words, the objection seems to be that the semantics that we have written down there doesn't properly characterise the real semantics. And so it seems like even here we're still appealing to the...
That would be to assume that our fundamental account of consequence is semantical. Right, which might be the right thing to assume.
No,
don't.
That's what this seems to be showing to me.
Where? Here.
So because it says that the semantics fail to capture genuine consequences and consequences that should be in application.
No. That's what I mean by saying that would be to assume that consequence is a true theoretic notion,
yeah,
which we're not doing just yet.
Yeah.
We'll end up doing that because it's plausibly correct, but for the time being we're leaving open that one might favour, and many people do favour, a proof theoretic treatment.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we do, right? That's why you do logic before you get anything else.
So don't assume that from the outset. It may well be true, and we're not going to do all that much by way of defending it. We will say something by way of defence. All I'm doing now is laying out that these are genuine options, right? There will be people. Indeed, there are people. I think there was at least one person in at least one of the seminars who was kind of sympathetic to a more proof-theoretic approach to consequence in general. And that's not a bad thing, right? There are plenty of theorists who are like that. There are theorists who think that truth shouldn't figure at all in one's account of logic. Okay, certain kinds of intuitionists sometimes said things in that vein. Okay, so that's just a general look at the dialectic going on between the defender of the proof theory and the defender of the truth theory. Now I want to look at one kind of proof theoretic account, one kind of account that looks like it sits most happily with the idea that consequence is most fundamentally shaped by appeal to a notion of proof rather than by appeal to notions of semantics. So on this view, I think I mentioned this in the seminars, on this kind of view, we're given the meanings of logical constants, things like and, if, then, not, by specification of basic rules of inference for those constants. So we're told things like this: from A and B, infer A and B, make that move in your deductions, that's okay. From A and B, infer A or infer B or both. Okay, those kinds of rules. So an introduction and elimination rule for that constant.
And then the idea is that those rules fully fix the meanings of the logical constants. They tell you everything there is to know about the meanings of those logical constants. And moreover, because they do that, these meaning-determining rules require no external justification. They just specify meanings. Like, let a vxen be a male fox. Say that, stipulate into existence a new expression of vxen, okay? Pairs up with vixens. And now I've done it. There's nothing to be criticised there, except on pragmatic grounds. It might be pointless to have an expression with that meaning, but you might think there's no other grounds on which one could challenge my right simply to stipulate into existence the meaning of some expression. And on this kind of view, that's what goes on when one learns, when one's told a system of rules of inference governing the behaviour of a particular logical constant. Now the account says that a conclusion C is a logical consequence of some premises X, just in case that conclusion can be deduced from the premises according to the meanings of the constants involved in the premises and conclusion. You're only allowed to operate on premises and conclusion in ways that are fixed by the meanings of the expressions involved in those various claims. And those meanings, in turn, were fixed by stipulation of the inference rules, the introduction and elimination rules governing the constants. So by repeated applications of those rules of inference that determine the meanings of the constants, one makes whatever transitions they allow, and if one can do that in a way that connects up premises and conclusion, you have a genuine case of consequence. It's not entirely clear who in the history of the subject has exactly taken this view. Okay, it looks as though Rudolf Carnap adopted a view of this kind, at least for a brief period. And it might be that other people adopted the view without fully specifying what they were doing. Right? Might be that there are traces of this kind of view in other theorists' work. But it's not entirely clear who's held this kind of view. The question for this kind of view is, well, why accept that as our account of consequence? And indeed, why accept that as our account of the way that the logical constants work? In particular, why accept that the inferences allowed for a particular constant determine its meaning, rather than that the inferences are determined by the meaning of an already extant meaning of those constants? Which would be what a defender of a truth theoretic account would be more likely to say. So a truth theoretic account might say, look, we know what and means. Okay? Given what and means, here's how you have to assign truth values to A and B, given the way you've assigned them to A and the way you've assigned them to B. And that's all fixed by the meaning of at. By contrast, this style of view wants to suggest that everything goes in almost the opposite direction. And stipulate which inferences are good inferences, thereby fixing the meaning, and then making those inferences, of course, is going to be in accord with the meanings of the expressions you've used. Nothing could ever go wrong, you might think, in tracing out inferences in accord with the meanings of the expressions involved in those inferences. But if those expressions have their meanings fixed just by these specific rules of inference, then as long as you carefully adhere just to those rules of inference, nothing's going to go wrong. Now, one kind of objection to this approach, and we're going to talk about more in seminars, comes from Arthur Pryor. So Arthur Pryor introduced the connective tonk, right, a new logical connective tonk, by appeal to stipulation of the following rules of inference governing the behaviour of tonk.
from any proposition P, infer P tonk Q. And from P tonk Q, infer Q. So introduction rule, from anything you like, infer P tonk anything else you like. And from anything you like, tonk anything you like, elimination rule, infer one side or another of the initial sentence. Now, obviously enough, I think, given minimal seeming background assumptions, right, for example, that consequence is going to be transitive, if you've got A having as a consequence B, and B having as a consequence C, then C will be a consequence of A. If you assume that, so you can put these applications of inference rules in series, if you assume that, then one can use tonk to prove that absolutely all arguments are logically valid. Okay. So, for example, it's Monday. Premise, it's Monday. It's Monday is an instance of P, so it allows that introduction of tonk anything you like. So you go, it's Monday, follows that it's Monday, tonk, Goldbach's conjecture, just via one application of tonk introduction. And then we apply tonk elimination to deliver Goldbach's conjecture as conclusion. So if tonk was okay, this would count as a decent proof of Goldbach's conjecture, albeit if this were Monday. So if I presented this proof on a Monday, I guess I would have won the Fields Medal. Okay. So tonk is problematic. It can't be a good way of delivering a connection between premises and genuine consequences. It's too profligate. So the result here is, at least according to Pryor, that one can't simply stipulate new connectives into existence. If one could, then one could stipulate tonk into existence with no cost, and if one could do that, then one could prove absolutely anything from absolutely any premises, and that's a crazy result, you might think. So minimally, there have to be rules of some kind governing the possibilities that are available, right? It's not free-for-all. There have to be some constraints or some rules governing the possibility of introducing a new connective in accord with some rules. That's the minimal result to this point. Okay, we've got to do something to rule out the possibility of introducing tonk. So now the question is, where do those rules or constraints come from? What delivers up, so to speak, meta-constraints that preclude the possibility of introducing tonk as a logical connective, but allow the introduction of connectives like and? Okay. In particular, the question is, are they proof-theoretic constraints, or are they rather truth-theoretic constraints? If they're truth-theoretic constraints, then this approach won't give us a more fundamental account of consequence than would be delivered by the truth-theoretic account. The only way to understand this kind of account and get it up and running in a viable way is by appeal to our prior understanding of the truth-theoretic or semantical account of consequence. Then that would be no good. Okay, so the defender of the proof-theoretic approach here has to think that they can give an account of the constraints to which the introduction of new constants has to adhere by appeal only to proof-theoretic resources. Okay? Can't appeal to truth theory. So Pryor seems to have thought that the rules here, the rules governing when it's okay to introduce a particular connective, were broadly truth-theoretic. He wasn't very explicit, actually, about
what he took the result to be. But he says that he was responding to attacks on what he calls the old superstitious view that an expression must have some independently determined meaning before we can discover whether inferences involving it are valid or invalid. Right, so the idea here is something like this, that we have to already have a grasp on what the meaning of a connected is, presumably one that governs something like its role in determining the truth values of whole sentences in which it figures, and only on that basis can we tell whether inference rules respect that meaning or fail to respect that meaning. Right, so it's because we can see that if A and B is true, then A is going to be true, right? Because we understand the meaning of and, we can see that kind of transition is going to be okay. That kind of transition will never lead us from a truth to a falsehood. And that's what governs why, that's what allows us to introduce and in the way we do. And see that it will never go against our semantic understanding of consequence. By contrast, we can also see what's wrong with tonk. Right? The problem with tonk is not only that it doesn't have a prior meaning, but moreover, that we can see that any meaning we'd assign to that constant, that connected, in accord with the inference rules that we're offered, would be out of accord with semantics. We can't give a semantical treatment of tonk that won't take us from a truth to a falsehood, right? Because we can start with any truth you like, and tonk will allow us to deliver any claim we like. And in that case, it'll always be possible, it seems, to go from a truth to a falsehood principle. Okay, so I want to pause there for about 10 minutes, till a couple of minutes past the hour, and then we'll come back and talk about Newell Belknap's response to Pryor on behalf of the proof theoretic approach to consequence, more or less. Okay, thanks.